From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with Alan Arkush, who directs movies and television. His movie credits include the cult film Rock and Roll High School. On television, Arkush has directed episodes of Moonlighting and St. Elsewhere. Also today, I'll talk with photographer Abigail Heyman. She's done hundreds of weddings. If your wedding photographer drove you crazy, you'll be interested in her approach. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward talks about the terror that swept through Nashville when a new kid named Elvis Presley became a hit. And our book critic John Leonard reviews Moscow 2042, a novel by Soviet exile Vladimir Voinovich about the future of Soviet society. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is Alan Arkush. He's one of a new breed of Hollywood directors who crosses back and forth between film, television, and videos. His TV credits include St. Elsewhere, L.A. Law, Bronx Zoo, Fame, and Moonlighting. He directed the episode of Moonlighting where the Cybill Shepherd and Bruce Willis characters finally make love. And he directed the episode of St. Elsewhere where Dr. Craig attempts to write his memoirs in several different genres. Arkush also directed the cult film Rock and Roll High School, which starred the punk band The Ramones. And he did the rock film Get Crazy. Those rock credits led him into directing rock videos, including Beast of Burden with Mick Jagger and Bette Midler. Alan Arkush studied film with Martin Scorsese at the New York University Film School. He got his start working for producer Roger Corman on his low-budget exploitation movies. We invited Alan Arkush to speak with us from the NPR studios in Los Angeles. I asked him why he first made the switch from directing movies to TV.
In a certain way, the movie business decided that it had enough of me. I had made a couple of movies. The most successful was probably Rock and Roll High School, and that was a success only in the sense that it was on midnight showings in theaters. Then I made Heartbeats, which did very poorly at the box office, and then I did a movie called Get Crazy, which had real distribution problems and was hardly run at all. And at that point, it was extremely difficult for me to get to do another movie. And I had been tagged by the movie business as someone who in their mind did only midnight movies, very strange movies, and thus the only things I got sent were more of that, but even weirder. Also, I found that the scripts on television were much, much better than the scripts in movies.
In what ways?
I think that they're more adult, I think that they investigate the nuances of characters more, and I think that they're written with much more craft and technique. They don't do things in the most obvious, straightforward manner. They find new ways to do scenes. I always kid Glenn Caron, who writes Moonlighting, and say, Glenn, this is a billiard scene, and that's sort of a code we have. A billiard scene is a scene where instead of trying to get the point to the scene by hitting it, the eight ball directly into the corner pocket, Glenn will write it so he does three cushions and then into the corner pocket. It's a way of doing something to make it more interesting. We're getting there is as much fun as being there.
Can you think of an example of that kind of...
The scene in Moonlighting where the show where Bruce and his father have a falling out because Bruce has slept with his father's bride-to-be. For the whole shooting of that episode, it pointed to the big scene where Bruce confronts the woman and says, don't you remember when we slept together? And we all thought it was going to be a four-page scene where they confront it, and Bruce realizes during the conversation that she has no idea who he is. And we figured 4 pages, we'll do the scene, no problem. The day before we're supposed to do the scene, it's now 11 pages long and features children of all nations singing It's a Small World. That's what I call doing it the hard way. And it built to this whole climax where the whole key line to the show is, wouldn't it be funny if we had slept together? And Bruce sort of supposed to say, yeah, wouldn't it? And he realizes that Mr. Macho made no impression at all on this woman, and his father, who he always thought of as being less sensitive than him, had. And the whole scene goes back and forth, and it's a wonderful scene. The actress gave a terrific performance, and this line is thrown away at the end of the scene. The whole point of the show, the punchline, is sort of done as a throwaway, because it's after the big emotional peak. And I directed it that way, and it worked perfectly. People really remember that moment.
Some people say that television is getting more adventurous as the movies are getting more formulaic. Do you think that's true?
oh, the things I've done on television are so much more far out than the things I've done on movies. We did a whole episode of Fame, which was a tribute to Sherlock Holmes, and we had the camera tilted, and we did shot part of it in black and white. I've done a ballet on Fame using traditional moves you see in Western movies and homages to Western music, where everything is done in black and white, and we take the mannerisms of a gunfight and turn them into a dance. The first episode of Moonlighting for next year is going to completely blow everyone's mind. It is, what we've done is so original, I can't give it away. But when you tune in, it's going to be a real surprise. It's one of those things that only Moonlighting can do. I've done things on St. Elsewhere where the dream sequences within dreams, within dreams. We've talked about topics that are far more serious and more important than you see in most movies today.
Ellen, you got your training at NYU Film School, and I know you studied with Martin Scorsese, who's since become one of America's leading directors. You credit him with having excited you about American films. Why were you overlooking American films at the beginning of your film school career?
There's an irony to that in the sense that I was brought up loving all American movies. You know, I went and saw Cowboy Pictures. I went and saw Rio Bravo. And I saw Shane, and I saw Lawrence of Arabia, and I saw lots of movies when I grew up. And when I got into high school, there's a certain snobism steps in. You start seeing foreign pictures. Then when you get to film school, everyone's watching foreign pictures because they are thought of as the more serious movies. And I started seeing Godard movies and Truffaut and Renoir, and I was really very much excited by all these foreign pictures. The American movies had sort of slipped to the background for me because also as a, and I put this in quotes, young intellectual in high school, I tended to look at things which were a little bit different and tried to seek out those things that were different. And so I was skipping school to go down to the Bleecker Street Cinema to see 8 and a half. Then in film school, there was also more access to these foreign pictures. And as time went on, I was interested in them and more in them. And I started seeing almost those movies exclusively, except the old movies that I saw on TV. Then in Marty's class, he started talking about all these directors, and I realized that Rio Bravo was directed by the great Howard Hawks, and that Shane was directed by George Stevens. So it was like all these movies that I'd loved as a kid, I now was able to validate intellectually because I started seeing more and more movies by Hawks and George Stevens and other people. So it sort of took me full circle, in that I was able to appreciate what I had liked as a child in innocence, I was able to appreciate intellectually as an adult.
You started to learn the craft of directing, doing films for Roger Corman, who's the king of B-movies, the king of schlock in a lot of ways. You started off doing trailers for his movies. What were some of the tricks you learned about how to sell a movie through a trailer?
Well, Roger was really interested in basically selling sex and violence. That was what we made each trailer point towards. So we would be doing trailers for movies like Big Bad Mama, TNT Jackson, Eat My Dust, Grand Theft Auto, Caged Heat. And a lot of these are directed by people who, Jonathan Demme, Jonathan Kaplan, Paul Bartel, that went on and directed lots of other movies. So we were all cutting these pictures. In the meantime, Roger was going off and buying foreign pictures. And at one point, he bought a picture by Fellini called Amarcord. And he called us to come down to the screening room, and we watched Amarcord. And it's a great movie. And we were awestruck by how good it was. And here we had just finished the trailer for TNT Jackson, Should Put You in Traction. And now we were starting the trailer for Fellini's Amarcord. And at the end of the movie, Roger says, I want you to sell the same things we always sell, sex and violence. It's always true. People like it, whether it's in Italian or it's in English. So we cut together a trailer, and it ran about 4 minutes long. We showed it to Roger, and we used the race car scenes from Amarcord and all the sexy shots of the women, and we used lots of pranks that the kids used. And it was a long trailer. Roger really liked it, and we sent it out to the theaters, and it was the biggest opening any Fellini movie had ever had. So there's a message in there somewhere. I mean, the fact that Roger Corman used to double bill Cries and Whispers with women in cages is a very bizarre concept, but a lot of people got to see Cries and Whispers. So in a sense, I learned how to sell a movie to a certain style of ad campaign. But by breaking movies down into their essential elements that made people want to come see them, I was able to really grasp how those elements were handled best. The best way to shoot a car crash scene after seeing so many action scenes, and how to condense thoughts down to their most cinematic and most powerful moments.
Now, I think Hollywood Boulevard, you did on a bet with Roger Corman. You bet him what, that you could make a movie cheaper than any movie he'd ever made?
And with more action in it. That was making a movie cheaper was no trick to him. He just wouldn't have let us have any more money. But making it with more action in it, that was a challenge. So what we did was we took all these action scenes that we had seen over and over during the last 2 years, and we took them out of their original movies. And you got to understand, these are Filipino war movies. These are women in prison movies. These are car chase movies, science fiction movies. And we designed the plot around it about murders on a movie set. And we went out into Malibu, and we gave our actresses machine guns, and they fired them right to left or left to right, and then we would cut to people falling out of trees right to left or left to right in these Filipino war movies. And that was how we shot all our action scenes. We never shot the action part. We only shot the reactions and the little bits that instigated the action.
Now, he must have been real proud of you.
And we cut it all together, and it came out, it cost $75,000, and it went on to make, I guess, about $1.5 million for Roger. I got paid $85 for directing the whole picture.
That's part of the reason why it was so cheap, right?
Oh, you bet. The costume budget was $250. The entire movie was made on short ends. It's a funny movie. When it's on cable now and I look at it, It's like it's a movie from another planet. It makes no sense whatsoever. People seem to like it because it's so surreal.
I bet one of the things that you learn when you work with Roger Corman is how to not be sanctimonious about movies.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, you can see a trend in my own thinking about movies going from slight teenage pretentiousness for foreign films to the reality of getting a job and making a movie and not taking what you do too seriously. There's nothing worse than a self-serious exploitation movie. You know, it just doesn't come off right, especially when you're trying to do a comedy. And when I made Rock and Roll High School, it was a conscious effort to not try and make a serious movie about teenagers who are disenfranchised from their high school. It just wasn't what we were trying to do.
Well, I've seen Rock and Roll High School, and it's set in a high school. The Ramones star in it, and it really reminded me of a lot of the rock and roll pictures from the early 60s, where, you know, the PTA does the frug at the end of the movie.
Exactly, like the plot of Rock, Rock, Rock. I think it's Rock, Rock, Rock. Lot of the inspiration was taken from those movies. I was trying to do a genre movie. I was trying to do a high school musical about how rock and roll is bad for you, and really focusing on punk music. The whole inspiration for it was my own high school experiences. In fact, many of the scenes in the movie were scenes I'd thought of in high school.
Such as?
Instead of the Ramones coming down the high school hallway playing, when I was in high school, I daydreamed that it was the Yardbirds. And I'd also daydream that we blew up the high school and that we had motorcycle races around the hallways. These are all things that I'd kept with me for years, and thus when I got to make the movie and I put them into the movie, there's a lot of truth to it in that it comes from a basic, strong emotion. And I think that's one of the reasons people respond so well to Rock and Roll High School, and that we've all been really frustrated by high school. Also, the Ramones just seemed like to be aliens from another world. And I wanted to do something about how music sort of fosters your fantasy life. And then one of the reasons we listen to music is to take us away from what our daily lives are like. And so I picked a group who I like, the Ramones, who are as different from the Southern California high school girls that the movie was about as possible. Also, they're a very unpretentious band.
Yeah, I'll say. Alan, let's talk again about working in television. You told us earlier about why you crossed over from movies to TV. You've done so many different TV shows. Do you get a style book when you're entering a TV show that's already in progress?
In a certain sense, if you do, in that there's a very strong look to each show that's a good show, and we're only talking about the really good ones. The ones, in a sense, on television, the auteur is the executive producer. And the executive producer sets a look and a style of acting and a subject matter. And when you if you want to do your job properly when you go from show to show, you really have to study the style of what they're after. In the case of St. Elsewhere, it was very easy for me since I had been a fan of the show. And one of the reasons I wanted to do the show is that I liked the way it was shot. I liked the handheld look and the mobility and the fact that scenes are long, unbroken takes. And I liked the way that the comedy is a very black humor and the way that it works so well with the dramatic storylines. Moonlighting, on the other hand, is completely opposite. Moonlighting is all long lenses, it's all portrait lighting, it's very much like an old Hollywood movie. We try to imitate the look of many movies from the 40s. And it's not as mobile, and since it's two characters, it's more cut back and forth, close up to close up, in the sense of, it's not an ensemble show. So much of our work takes place in either the moonlighting agency or in Maddie's house or at David's apartment or else in the car. St. Elsewhere takes place in a hospital, moving from room to room and operating rooms. So if you're going to do your job well, you really have to learn the styles. And in doing that, you pick up a lot of things that you wouldn't normally try. That's the great thing about television. You can try something and see it on the air 3 or 4 weeks later and say, well, that worked or that didn't work. And it's not like your career depends on it the way it is with a movie where it's 2 years of anticipation and it comes out and it has such a short shelf life. It plays for a week or two or maybe, you know, if it's a hit, 2 or 3 months, and then it's gone.
No, the way you're describing it, it's reminding me of the days of the old Hollywood studios when directors would get lots and lots of films to do, and they would churn it out, and some of the films would be great, and some of them wouldn't be, but there'd be a lot of work.
Yes, and in a lot of ways, this is like that. It is going from Moonlighting to St. Elsewhere to L.A. Law. It's like going from one genre to another genre. And it's fun to do. This year, I'm going to basically concentrate on Moonlighting since it's been so successful for me. And I really love the show and I love the characters. And I think we're onto something really exciting now with the new relationship between Maddie and David and what's going on with them. Then I'm going to stay with them. When you move around from show to show, when you first sort of come in, it's a bit like being the substitute teacher in school. Everyone wants to see how much they can get away with. And then once you've done a couple of shows, they get used to you, they know what you do. It becomes a more comfortable working arrangement.
Alan, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back. My guest is Alan Arkush, who directs for television and the movies. He's speaking to us from Los Angeles. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Alan Arkush, who has directed for movies and TV. On television, he's directed episodes of Fame, Moonlighting, and St. Elsewhere. His film credits include Get Crazy and Rock and Roll High School. You directed the first show where the Cybill Shepherd and Bruce Willis characters have sex on Moonlighting. And I was wondering if there was a lot of discussion that you were in on about whether this was a good idea or not. You know, whether they should have sex in the series or not.
There was endless discussion on this topic. It's one of the main things that's discussed about the show in general. And finally, when Glenn Caron made the decision to do that, he really wanted to have a storyline based a lot around Cybill, because Bruce carries a lot of the more comedic shows around Cybill and what would happen if a man really fell for Maddie Hayes. And that's where the Mark Harmon character came from. And working it over the course of 4 episodes really got us a lot of time to work out all the different permutations and all the different things that could happen between 3 people. So when the decision was made to actually do the love scene, we were pretty sure that was absolutely the right thing to do. And we'd also run out of ways to not have the love scene.
You play that last episode for lust and also for sight gags. The Bruce Willis character was knocking over all the furniture, all the tchotchkes and vases in the living room as they were passionately going about making love. Well, they're both very self-conscious during that scene, because after all, this is the first time their characters did this together. It was a real high point in the series.
That was one of the most difficult episodes, difficult hours of anything I've ever directed. Aside from the fact that here had been building for 2.5 years, and if it wasn't a great love scene, well, you know, it just wasn't going to be up to what everyone's expectations were. And we had the problem that Sybil was pregnant with twins, is pregnant with twins, and the fact that during the shooting of that episode, Bruce Willis had a skiing accident and broke his collarbone, and Mark Harmon had to leave because he had was on the contract for a limited amount of time, had to leave partially through the shooting of the episode. So a lot of it is done with doubles, and the big love scene, because Bruce and Sybil were so physically uncomfortable, Bruce because of his collarbone and her because of her pregnancy, was done, the stuff on the floor was done with doubles, and the two of them in bed and rolling around on the floor was actually done with them standing up. And we took the carpet and mounted it on a platform of wood. They stood there, and we aimed the camera above them so it looked like it was shooting down on them on the floor.
Sex isn't what it used to be.
No, it isn't. And there was a lot of discussion as to how passionate they'd be, and there was a lot of discussion about when they call each other bitch and bastard. And also a lot of discussion as to how to make it seem that it was mutual, that it wasn't one person having a conquest over the other.
So are you pleased with the way it worked out?
I'm very pleased, and I couldn't be happier with the choice of music, since Be My Baby is one of my favorite songs, one of the greatest rock songs of all time. I like the way the show came out, and the editors kept telling me, this is going to be a good one, this is going to be a good one. And then when I saw it all cut together and on the air, and I found that the next day that 60 million people had seen it also, I was pretty pleased.
What happened with Moonlighting this year? It seems that there were very few new episodes, and some of the new episodes didn't arrive on time. They were late by several weeks.
Oh, we just never are on time. We're not even close to being on time. We sort of proceed at our own pace and try to get out as much new stuff as possible. But it takes 3 weeks to do an episode of Moonlighting, at least. And now that Sybil's pregnant, it can take as long as 5 weeks because it's very difficult for her to work a full shooting day. So that when a show's supposed to be on every week, that's a real math problem is presented. And it's just the nature of the way we do the show. There's a philosophy there that we don't want to do a show on schedule just to do it on schedule. We'd rather give the audience something that's special. And I think it shows up on the screen and certainly hasn't hurt the popularity of the show.
You've done several programs for Moonlighting and St. Elsewhere where there's film parodies going on or literary parodies. And I wonder if you think of yourself as part of a new breed of director in television. And what I'm referring to is people who are passionate about movies, not just television, and who bring in all kinds of film references and film parodies as well into TV shows.
Well, when you get to work as much as I do, you really get to draw on all your knowledge. And one of the things that we try and do is use as much film techniques as possible and not just settle for the most efficient way to shoot a scene. There's ways to shoot scenes, you know, where you get the crew out early or you get the show done on schedule, but it's not as interesting. In the case of Moonlighting, for instance, the cameraman and I talk all the time about what each scene will look like, and we make a very conscious effort to capture a look. In the show where Mark Harmon proposes to Sybil Shepherd, and she's standing near her couch, and it's the middle of the night, and he's offered to make her lamb, the light across her face, cameraman's setting up the shot, and I look at it, and I said, Marlena Dietrich? And he said, no, Joan Crawford. And it was a conscious effort to do a specific style of lighting. Sometimes when we do our daylight scenes, we try to get an ominous overtone to them on Moonlighting, and the daylight scenes in The Office or else in Maddie's house, and we'll try and emulate, say, an RKO movie from the mid-40s. And that's a common language. It's a common reference to people who know film history. So it's a way of shortcutting and getting to that look. I also love to do replicate sequences. There's all kinds of problems in shooting a scene, and sometimes you'll remember a scene from a movie that's like what you're doing, and you'll go back and look at it and see how the various problems were solved by a great director or a great cameraman. And I really try to keep my style changing and keep learning things. So I'm constantly watching movies. I watch 250, 300 movies a year. I watch movies all the time, so I try to use as much of that in my work as possible and take the good things out of classical movie making. Also, this is an age of sort of postmodernism and modernism in general, where art makes references to itself. You see it in paintings, you see it now a lot in television, and you see it definitely in movies. So there's in Moonlighting, for instance, when Bruce turns to the camera and winks, that's what I call a modernist point of view. There's an irony there. And we use it whenever we feel the plot is going in the most obvious place. It's like time to let the audience know that we know that we're just going through the motions here so we can continue our story.
Do you run into a lot of people who you don't know, and when you introduce yourself, they know your name, but they can't quite place it?
Yes, it happens a lot, because on television, your name's on the screen for about 2 seconds. And then they say, what do? And you say, well, you direct this show or that show. And then you say, what episodes? And people really remember the episodes. When I say I directed the episode where the woman becomes a chocoholic on St. Elsewhere, everyone remembers her, you know, with the pastry gun in her mouth, trying to commit suicide by chocolate. The Moonlighting episode about Bruce and his father. There are certain episodes I've done that seem to stand out, and they're distinctive enough so that people remember them.
Are your friends more impressed by the fact that you've done movies or television?
It's really a hard question, because
your friends all work. Your friends all work in movies and television.
Yeah, it depends. You know, if they like, some of my friends love some of my movies, and some of my friends don't like some of my TV series because they just don't like the characters or the shows. I find that when you leave Hollywood and you're out there in the rest of the country, people are probably more impressed that you do television. They're really, really impressed that you do Moonlighting, and they love those shows. People look forward very strongly to having, you know, Maddie and David in their living room, or the cast of St. Elsewhere or L.A. Law at home and watching their exploits every week. And I wasn't until I started doing more and more television that I realized how powerful that is, that it's really something to be able to communicate to that many people on a weekly basis and have the room to take them all places with a character that you wouldn't normally get to if you were just doing a movie and dropping the character after 95 minutes.
There was a time when doing television was seen as a step down from doing film, and I think once you were doing TV, you were kind of out of the film world. Now, you're about to do another movie, a National Lampoon movie. Is it no longer true that doing television is looked down on by people in films?
I think doing the good television shows is definitely thought of very highly. I think anyone who's able to do the shows that I do and that the other directors do these shows are top-notch directors. I go to the movies all the time, and I'll tell you, there's no status to doing a bad movie. And directors like Mark Tinker, who directs St. Elsewhere, or Peter Werner, who's directed a lot of Moonlighting, these people are world-class directors. And if they were doing feature films, they would be doing the important feature films. It's just that they're choosing, in a lot of cases, to produce and direct, you know, TV shows. So I think people move back and forth. And then certainly there's been a lot more interest in me and in me directing movies since I've been directing these key shows. People are able to see my work and see the variety of things that I can do. They don't just think of me as the guy who did Rock and Roll High School now. They realize I can do dramatic stuff and I can do romantic comedies.
Alan Arkush, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been director Alan Arkush. His TV credits include Moonlighting, L.A. Law, and St. Elsewhere. He also directed the film Rock and Roll High School. He's currently directing the new National Lampoon film, College Bound. He spoke to us from NPR's Los Angeles Bureau. This is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with writer Joyce Carol Oates, so I hope you can join us. This is The Ramones from the Alan Arkush film Rock and Roll High School. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, photographer Abigail Heyman talks about shooting wedding scenes the official photographers would never shoot for a wedding album. Book critic John Leonard reviews the new Vladimir Voinovich novel, Moscow 2042. It's the exiled writer's satiric look at the future of communism. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward talks about Nashville's response to the rise of rock and roll, and we'll have the latest news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. It's time for the news. This is Fresh Air. According to our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, back in the 50s, rock and roll took most of the country by storm, but it took Nashville by surprise. This is how it was.
Well, that long black train got my baby and gone.
When Elvis Presley burst onto the scene in 1954, he scared a lot of people, but probably nowhere were there more scared folks than in Nashville. Nashville was the seat of country music then, as it is now, and its record executives prided themselves on knowing what was going on. This Presley kid with his so-called rockabilly wasn't part of the plan at all. No sooner had Elvis's record started selling outside of Memphis than Nashville split into two camps. One camp was horrified. If he were left unchecked, this rhythm and blues influence could ruin country music. The other camp decided there was money to be made, and from the sound of these records, you could make it without a whole lot of skill, so it should be easy to copy. Now, Nashville's a pretty conservative town, so the big labels waited a while to see if this thing were a bandwagon or not before deciding to jump onto it. But as more rockabilly started showing up on the radio, it became clear that this wasn't a fad, it was a trend. The horrified types took the tack of trying to ban this music on country radio. This wasn't a racist issue, as some people have thought, though. There's been a strong black influence in country music since the 30s, what with Jimmy Rogers' blues and Bob Wills' western swing. No, this was an attempt to keep country music free of any kind of pop influence. But the other camp decided that imitation was the sincerest form of flattery, and that's where they blew it big time.
I got a gal about 5'3". Boy, she can really make love to me. Gonna roll, gonna rock, gonna roll and rock. We're gonna rock our blues away. I wanna shave and powder and shine my shoes. Get my baby and lose them blues. Gonna roll, gonna rock, gonna roll and rock. We're gonna rock our blues away.
The earliest imitations were just up-tempo country songs with a few buzzwords added, like this 1955 recording, I'm Gonna Rock and Roll by Eddie Zack and Cousin Richie. Sometimes the instrumental backing was pretty hot, like on this early Freddie Hart record, Dig Boy Dig.
If you wanna live it up and drive a limousine, have plenty money in your blue jeans, and a lot of pretty women hanging on your wing, pay attention, man, you will get just what I mean. You got a dig, boy, dig, boy, dig.
But the lyrics sounded like what they were, the product of a professional songwriter out of touch with the teenagers he was courting. And then there were the really out-of-it records like Go Away, Hound Dog, and You Ruined My Blue Suede Shoes. Nashville couldn't have figured out that rock and roll was a feeling, a way of life that had grown up alongside country music. Like the rest of America, Nashville thought rock and roll was a fad, and once you get past the clumsy attempts to nab a market nobody understood, you can find some charming songs. One of my favorites is by a bluegrass group, Don Reno, Red Smiley, and the Tennessee Cut-Ups, and it's called Country Boy Rock and Roll.
You can't tell I'm from the country, see I'm from out of town. come in, Billy started picking. Everybody rock and roll, I better rock and roll, I better roll it. I guess to some folks I look pretty, just let it make a fool out of me.
You know, I don't think Nashville ever figured out what rock and roll was all about. Performers who were capable of it rarely recorded any there. And when they tried to cram country singers into a rock and roll straitjacket, they sounded profoundly uncomfortable. Eventually, pop radio picked up on rockabilly and country stations stopped playing it, except for performers who fall through the cracks like Johnny Cash. Today, bands like Jason and the Scorchers and Webb Wilder prove that rock and roll in Nashville aren't oil and water after all. It became a dead issue when everybody realized there was no reason to fight. They were all on the same side.
Rock historian Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle and is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll.
I got a hole in my pocket and I can't go to the fair. I got a hole in my pocket and I can't go to the fair.
You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is photographer Abigail Heyman. Her new collection of photographs is a book titled Dreams and Schemes, Love and Marriage in Modern Times. All the photographs were taken at weddings, hundreds of them, from two-minute quickies at City Hall to lavish parties at large family homes. At only two of these ceremonies was she the official wedding photographer. I asked her then what was her role at these weddings and what was she looking for?
I've had a very peculiar role at weddings. I sort of go in and I generally try to bring a gift and sort of announce myself as part guest, but I've got cameras and I'm part photographer. But I'm not a photographer responsive to what they're going to need. I always hope I'm going to do photographs that the family will enjoy, but I'm really looking at it more as an outside journalist, and yet I'm not an outside fly on the wall. I'm also a participant at the wedding. It's a very peculiar relationship, and because there is no standard for that or there is no tradition for that, people don't know quite what to do with me.
I know that there's some weddings where you've been to where you've been there as a friend or as a journalist, and at the same time there's also an official photographer mm-hmm. doing mm-hmm. the wedding. Can you compare what you're doing on those days with what the official photographer is doing who's working the room at the same time?
The official wedding photographer, it's a very difficult job, is really looking for what the bride and groom or the bride and groom's families are going to be wanting to look at for 50 years and the way and the images that they're going to want to remember of this day. I'm looking for emotional responses to the event that often the family isn't even aware of. You know, the mother may be very unhappy because the daughter is leaving her home, even though she loves the new groom. But she's not particularly aware that that's as prominent as it is to me.
What's your criteria for going to weddings that you're not invited to as a friend? Because I know you've been to weddings just as a photojournalist.
Lots of different things can interest me, and they're very different. It can be the visual scene. In photographing Dreams and Schemes, I photographed in a lot of different subcultures, not because I felt the weddings were really different, but because I think it gave me different visual clues to look at and enjoy in addition to what was going on in the wedding itself. There would be strange little things going on in families. I remember picking one article out of the New York Times of a couple I wanted to photograph who were getting married because they both had only children of exactly the same age. And I thought, if you'd been an only child for 9 years in your life, wouldn't it be incredible to suddenly have a sibling of the same age? So there would be little family stories that would interest me that I would hear one way or another.
But now, you're photographing from a really different perspective, but people don't know whether you're the official paid photographer or a friend of the families or what. So what do they do when they see you coming with the camera?
Well, very often they ask me what I'm doing, and I explain it as best I can. It's obvious that I'm not the wedding photographer because I don't have the same kind of equipment, and people seem to recognize that.
Have you ever told someone to smile for the camera?
I don't think I ever have, but...
Why not? Because we all seem to really prize photographs with smiles on them.
Well, I think I have. Sometimes people will ask me, would you take a picture of me with Aunt Bessie and so forth? And then I will, and then conventionally I'll ask them to smile. More often I'll ask them to look at me. We expect that as a sign of happiness, and I think most people think they want to remember the event and all the people as being happy. In fact, I don't believe that's true. For example, there are goodbyes that are very sad and deeply felt, and I think people are glad to have those photographs afterwards. But they don't expect to be taken in an unhappy pose. It's just one of our really deep expectations about photographs.
You probably end up talking to the bride and groom at the wedding while you're photographing them. Do they ever confess doubts to you about the marriage?
Yes, a lot. But I don't photograph, I don't talk to them so much at the wedding when other people are around and they're usually pretty busy. But very often I come a few hours before the wedding and everybody is off fixing things up and planning. And the bride and groom are very often left alone with no one to talk to. And that's a time when they often talk about their fears.
Is this something you want to hear if a groom confesses that, I don't know if I'm really doing the right thing?
Well, your question is interesting, Terry, because you say if a groom confesses as though he had told this big secret. And I know from being married and from having been through a wedding myself and from being now to a few hundred weddings that everybody has fears. They may be that the wedding doesn't work out. They may not, more often they're not conscious of that the marriage won't work out. And more often what people are afraid of is not whether it'll work out or not, but things are going to change. And they don't know how they're going to change. Nobody really knows.
And it's this kind of emotion that you want to register in your photographs.
Yes, exactly. These are the kind of the hidden parts of a wedding. And partly I've concentrated on them because they are so hidden and most of us are terribly unaware. Most people go to a wedding and think of it as a rather superficial event, whereas really lives are changing so dramatically in that symbolic way.
You've been through two weddings yourself, and there are photos of each.
That's right.
In your new book. Now, one of them is from 1965. You're shown with shoulder length hair and a very neatly done page boy. You're wearing a veil with a big white bow on top, a very conservatively cut white wedding gown with lace on the sleeves. You're formally posed in much the same way that a graduation picture is formally posed, and you're not smiling. We'll get to your other wedding picture in a moment, but what do you think about when you see that picture?
Well, I think for me, I feel rather sad because I didn't feel very in touch with that wedding. In the sense, as I wrote in the book, I didn't really want to get married at that time, but it was the appropriate thing to do. It was what my parents expected of me. It filled certain needs in my life, though I don't think at that point I was thinking about what the rest of my life would be like. And I really didn't know what being married meant in a very naive way. So there's a certain sadness of having been not quite there, of having not really understood what it was all about.
There's also a 1978 photo of your second wedding. And in this one, your hair is all frizzed out and you have a very playful smile on. I can't tell what you're wearing because it's obscured by, I think, some flowers on the table.
Yes.
But it looks like you might be wearing a tank top. Maybe it's a formal gown, but I couldn't really tell.
No, I think it was a tank top, in fact.
Very different than the formal pose of the 1965 wedding. What do you think about when you see that photo?
Well, it was a very different kind of wedding. I knew a lot more about what marriage meant, and I knew my husband much better. So the sense of tension was less because of that. I had more of an awareness of what was happening.
What did you want from the wedding pictures of each of these two weddings?
I wanted to remember, I guess, what the day was like. And I think that's true of both wedding pictures. I think they both really reflect what I was feeling. And I think those wedding pictures are very important. It's important for me to have a memory of what those days felt like. And I think it's very interesting that the formal posed photograph also tells me what that day looked like and what it felt like.
As a person who's been through one marriage and is in a second marriage, you don't necessarily believe in the absolute permanence of marriage. What is it about weddings and marriages that still keeps the wedding ceremony so moving for you?
I think they're incredibly interesting. I think they, in a sense, bring out the best in everyone. So I really have enjoyed people and I've enjoyed weddings. I enjoy the champagne and I enjoy the dancing. But mostly I think I see an incredible emotional response to family life there. That's not just for the bride and groom. It's for the parents. It's often many of the weddings I was photographing, there were children of the bride or children of the groom. It's multi-generational. There are friends who are losing their best friend. All kinds of things are changing for many people. It's not just for the bride and groom.
Abigail Heyman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Abigail Heyman's new book of photographs is called Dreams and Schemes, Love and Marriage in Modern Times. She spoke with us from New York.
Go into the chapel and we're gonna get married. Go into the chapel and we're gonna get married.
This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
So Paul Volcker is leaving the Federal Reserve Bank.
Yes, he is, and he's to be replaced by Alan Greenspan. We'll be hearing some reaction to that from the business community, and also a little talk with one of Mr. Volcker's former bosses, Jimmy Carter, about what kind of man Paul Volcker is.
How are you following today's Iran-Contra hearings?
Well, we'll have a report on what Assistant Secretary of State Elliot Abrams said today, and also on what he has said in the past about his knowledge of aid to the Contras. And in other matters, we'll be talking with a fellow named Jim Kaplan, who's written a book called Playing the Field. It's about fielding, not Henry, but baseball fielding. He says it's the most fascinating part of that sport.
Okay, thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Vladimir Voinovich is a Soviet writer now living in exile in West Germany. His first novel since being expelled from Russia is called Moscow 2042. Our book critic John Leonard says this political satire, which includes time travel and tales of exile, begins where Animal Farm left off.
They kicked Vladimir Voinovich out of the Soviet Union in 1980 because he made fun of them, all of them. The Red Army and the housing shortage, literary careerists, collective farmers, secret police, mothers who name their newborn twins Overtake and Surpass, and Moscow intellectuals who discuss the best way to have sex with a chicken. Russian writers who make jokes are always compared to Gogol. This is unfair to Voinovich. Gogol was sicker and gloomier. Gogol strangled cats and was afraid of caterpillars. Voinovich is a subversive giggler. In his several novels about the stumpy, lop-eared, knobby-headed, blissfully innocent and invincibly ignorant Private Ivan Chonkin, he plants booby traps. Language explodes. The state doesn't so much wither away as it is hollowed out and then tickled to death. Voinovich reminds me more of Dostoevsky at his most playful. We tend to forget that Dostoevsky, who read most of Dickens, had a slapstick side. Voinovich slaps and snaps a lot of sticks. Moscow 2042 is a parody of Orwell's 1984. A Russian writer in Western exile named Vitya is very much like Voinovich himself and flies 60 years into the future to find out what's happened to communism. His way is paid by the CIA, although there are other interested parties, including the Arabs and another Soviet writer in exile named Sim. Sim, with his pan-Slavic mysticism, his North American fortress, his hatred of rock music, and his megalomania, will remind you immediately of Solzhenitsyn. I won't tell you everything that's going on in the future, just a little bit. As we might expect from Voinovich, even totalitarianism is a shambles. There is perfect communism in only one city, and that is Moscow, surrounded by rings of varying hostility. The names of the streets have, of course, been changed again, and the food is even worse, especially the vegetarian pork chop. Life is divided into primary and secondary matter, which refers not only to the waste cycle, but to art and rhetoric as well. There is no music allowed, except for a weird Ukrainian folk singer who follows Vitya through time and space. All is ruled by a genialissimo, the ultimate and immortal leader, who looks down, like a fish in an aquarium, from a space satellite. Meanwhile, waiting in the wings is the last of the Romanovs, who is none other than Sim, the sort of Solzhenitsyn, frozen by cryogenics, and, with his white horse, stashed like a popsicle in a Swiss bank vault, ready to lead Russia back into the Middle Ages. The rub here is that the Muscovites of 2042 have already read the book that Vitya will write when he gets back from his trip to the future. They want him to revise and delete certain passages so as to eliminate certain historical possibilities. He has more problems out of time than, say, Michael J. Fox or Kathleen Turner, but history and literature and laughter and pluralism win. Communism and Solzhenitsyn and the CIA and even Orwell lose. And I had a grand, wicked time. Imagine, if you can, S.J. Perlman writing the libretto for Wagner's Ring Cycle.
Fresh Air's book critic John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with comic Emo Phillips. His insecure, neurotic, post-adolescent persona has gotten him spots on Letterman, as well as his own records and an HBO special. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review the career of Pulitzer Prize-winning composer John Harbison, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will discuss how inept we Americans are when it comes to foreign languages. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.